This episode of The Stack was first broadcast on Saturday, the 22nd of June, 2013, on Monocle 24.
A happy convert from digital to print, a nice big read focusing on the world of fashion, our man in Barcelona on a new discovery, and much more on edition 43 of The Stack. As ever, there's lots to read and rifle through on the program, and in a moment, we'll be spending a full hour or so with Rob Alderson of Printed Pages, but first, a sneak preview of his must-reads.
I've got a brand new magazine from Berlin, which focuses on a single street. I've got the food special of Special Request, which is restoring my faith in food magazines. And I've got the Green Soccer Journal, because if I can bang on about one magazine, it's going to be that one.
And our Liam Alders hits the Catalan kiosk and finds this.
This is what makes me happy. Like, this magazine is actually my personal search for happiness in the editorial world.
All that, and as usual, a little bit more right here on The Stack on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to this 43rd edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly flip and fold over of the best in periodicals from across the planet. I'm Tyler Brulé. In case you missed last week's show, we were live from the heart of our country fair where we witnessed Mag Culture's Jeremy Leslie dip his toe into the world of running London's first super premium newsstand. We'll be talking all about moving from screen to page and even back again, and perhaps continuing the theme next week from the streets of Bangkok. But before we touch down in Suvarnabhumi Airport, let's meet our guests around the table here in London in Studio One. And joining us around the table here in Studio One at Midori House is Susan Connie Marsh, editor-in-chief and creative director of the London-based Under the Influence magazine. Now, for listeners who have not seen the title, it kind of brings back memories of really original W magazine. When you used to get W magazine, probably like the March or the April issues, or also September issue and October issues as well, I guess circa, what would we be saying, probably mid-90s. You've got this wonderful format, Susan. We're looking at your spring-summer issue right now, the coming-of-age issue, and a great cover shot that probably everyone will recall. It's a Brooke Shields shot on the cover of the magazine, but quite a hefty tome. So for those listening who aren't familiar with the title, tell us about Under the Influence.
Well, it's a biannual publication. Started in 2008 in Paris. I was actually based there for 5 years before recently moving back to London. It's curated around a theme each issue, and all our collaborators work around that theme to produce the work for the issue, including the fashion, the essays, the articles, and the interviews.
And from a format point of view, has it been evolutionary? It had a life before 2008 as well, and then you've been, of course, at the head of the show since then. But was it always this format, this weight, or has that also been evolutionary as well?
It's been getting thicker. It's always been the same format size-wise, but each edition tends to keep growing. So, yeah.
Which is a good thing. Yeah. I always, of course, like to get into, maybe we shouldn't jump into the business plan right at the top. But here you have, I mean, it's serious in terms of heft and weight. You know, certainly not too many ads as well. I mean, you open up with Valentino and also not selling them the opening spread. A confident cover price, and I would say very good value. If you're buying it in France, it's €12. If you're buying it on this side of the channel, £9.50. When you look at the marketplace and you said it is getting thicker, you know, is part of that a desire to, of course, deliver value for money for a reader? Does it have to do with also just, you know, even more awareness over the years in terms of the contributions you're getting? What contributes to that, do you think?
I think mainly the contributions we're getting are just stronger. There's more of them and we are loath to cut them. Mm-hmm. So it's something that's just happened organically in that sense, but also we don't want to suddenly cut down the page sizes for the readers who've been paying that price since we started. It has crept up gradually, but we'd like to stay around that price. We'd have to
Right. Well,
we have to see how that
we'll talk about creative bases as well, I guess where one is better editing a title, either this city, we could open up a whole debate about it as well, or the other side of the channel as well. In the meantime, though, I want to introduce Rob Alderson. He's the editor of Printed Pages. Now he had a start. Well, can we say it's the other side of the screen, in front of the screen? I'm sure you're always still in front of a screen doing this title, but of course, it's an evolution, of course, from It's Nice That magazine, which of course has many, many fans, and it's probably one of the titles that has really sort of set the tone since we brought the Stack to air as well. Last weekend, as I was saying at the top of the program, we had our country fair, which I was mentioning, Jeremy Leslie's table that Mag Culture was running here. And it was amazing just to see the interest in your launch issue. A wonderful, very tactile, I wouldn't say sky blue. It could be sort of a sky blue, but with a thunderstorm approaching. Great contributions by the like of Nadav Kander, Jeff McFetteridge, Stuart Smith, and many others. So we're looking at the summer issue. Tell us about how we ended up here, going from screen to a lovely saddle-stitched print edition.
Mm-hmm. I think what happened, you mentioned the previous It's Nice That magazines, and I think when that finished, we went away for a year. We didn't bring out anything printed, and it was great. It was a great opportunity for us to rethink what we were doing with the magazine. One of the very things we started with was cover price. We went into some magazine shops near our Shoreditch office, and not only did everything kind of look the same, but everything was priced kind of in the same area. Yeah. And actually, that was almost a starting point, was that, the whole It's Nice That thing is about accessibility and getting art and design into, the hands of people, and particularly young people. And so actually we started, it's £4 is the cover price, we have on it. And that was kind of the first set of decisions. And then everything came from that, and it was what design decisions we have to make that means we can put it out at that price. But we were always confident in our ability with content and to reach out to people. And I think, what's fantastic is that whatever you think about the design or certain visual bits or anything, I don't think anyone would say it's not value for money and that it's not a good read and you don't get those kind of things. But I mean, it's always a constant surprise how open people are to doing things with us and to taking part. And so that transition, that journey is always kind of slightly easier than maybe we always fear when we start with that blank sheet of paper. And like
tell me though, so just to, we'll go over the cover price. If you bought it here, £4 in the UK, €7, $8, not very specific, could be Canadian dollars, Aussie dollars, US dollars, somewhat almost all on par at the moment. But you mentioned accessibility. You wanted to bring something out that wasn't a vanity read, that, and I guess where I'm going with this, was it about creating a new sense of awareness where so many people are going online, they're using digital as a research resource at the moment, and was this really about trying to get a bit of ink and paper in between people's fingers?
I think so. I think there was always a thing, with the website, which is such a kind of voracious beast that needs feeding, all the time with content. There was always stories we couldn't tell online. There was always things that we couldn't do. But also I'm sure like us all, we're complete kind of print obsessives, and, we wanted to show that there is a way of doing this, and that actually, the center spread, for example, there is a huge nude Nadav Kander portrait. That's an experience you can't get online when you're just scrolling down. It's a beautiful image, but that shock of opening it up and seeing it's a very stark black and white image, for me, that element of happenstance and surprise, you can only do that in print. So that was always
Where do you see yourself sitting on the newsstand? Because it has a unique position, and Susan, I want to come back to you about this as well. On one side, we've seen a slimming down of titles covering the creative patch that might be appealing to a slim audience of art directors and graphic designers and art buyers, etc. But then, the other side, there's, we've also seen this certain type of spike as well. So do you see yourself as industry talking to industry? Because maybe that's the association. Or was this also about creating a broader base?
I think it's definitely, my background is in journalism rather than creative industries. And one of my big things was always that anyone could pick this up, actually, whether you went to art school or not, and not feel intimidated. That's a really big thing we wanted to get. But the reason I laugh when you ask where it sits on the newsstand physically is we've had it next to everything from boating magazines to pornography. So, newsagents, people don't know where to place
happens.
It.
Yes, it happens all the time.
Yeah. But no, I think it's definitely one of the driving forces was to say, there's this amazing stuff, there's this amazing art and design that potentially the big audience aren't aware of, and for us to try and find a way to get it in their hands, definitely.
Mm. Susan, for you, where this title, maybe you do end up in the porn section sometime, or you could be anywhere on the newsstand, but hopefully just the scale and impact that you have. Here we've seen maybe a thinning out, we've seen a reformatting of traditional fashion titles and style mags, etc. We saw, a complete real collapse of a lot of the titles which defined the 80s and early 90s in the UK. The same also happened in Germany and many other markets. And then there you are. You've been around for some time, of course, with a biannual frequency. Where do you see yourself? And is it pretty clear when you're out on newsstand? And of course, oftentimes when I've seen you on newsstand, your positioning is really, it's the right place. I mean, it's not mm-hmm. something which where you have to worry about the people showing up at W.H. Smith in the morning. You're certainly pitched it at a higher level of newsstand and kiosk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we put in different categories all the time as well. Often we're on the art stands, and again, then we're over with the fashion magazines. So I think it depends what people read into the magazine. There's a huge percentage of fashion in there, fashion photography and discussions about that industry, but there's also a huge section of art, articles and essays. So it really, it's kind of up to the reader to decide exactly what they think we are. And I think our readership's quite broad in that sense. But what you mentioned earlier about being industry magazine as well, I know that we've been classed very much as an industry magazine.
Something that you fight against or?
No, not at all. I think it's great. I think it's good. I see we're referenced quite a lot. And when that's in one sense when we talk to people in the industry where people actually do know us. So that's, it's great to have that. And people talk about the imagery a lot and the sense of the curation of the images within Under the Influence. So happy to be there.
We're going to discuss much more than, of course, just positioning, as the program says, and build and advertised. We've got some pretty good magazines to rummage through over the course of this next little stretch of the program. Going away for a very short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
It's that time of year when Monocle's mighty July-August double issue hits the newsstands with a glorious and satisfying thud. The issue where we name the best cities to call home, meet the people who know how to run a good metropolis, check out the businesses that care about more than profits, and also find a few dustier, grittier places that you should know. Here's what our editors have lined up for you to enjoy on your lounger.
In the design section, we go street cleaning with the wonderful Greenbird team in Tokyo. We knock on the doors of the people who live in the pioneering Harlan estate outside Bern, and we strip off for a steamy fashion story in Helsinki's newest, cutest public sauna.
In the edit section, we take you for a stroll around some of the world's best public parks, including Singapore Gardens by the Bay, Margaret Island in Budapest, and São Paulo's Ibirapuera Park, three places where you can work out surrounded by nature, sculptures, and open-air cinema.
The July-August issue of Monocle also includes our inaugural 68-page food and entertaining guide and a 24-page Rio de Janeiro survey. It will keep you content with content all summer long. It's on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
And you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. My guests today are Susan Connie Marsh, editor-in-chief and creative director of the London-based Under the Influence magazine, and also Rob Alderson, editor of Printed Pages. And we have the almost box fresh summer edition in front of us here as well. A little bit earlier in the program, Susan, you mentioned that the magazine was in Paris. It's now in London. Why did you and the team buy a seat on Eurostar?
Well, that was partly a personal and partly a work decision, because I'd been based there for 5 years and I wanted to move back to the UK. And also we thought it would be beneficial for the publication, since it was an English language publication and it had a lot of roots in the UK anyway, to be back here. Mm. My partner on the magazine, Xavier Encinas, he's still based in Paris, so it's still, it kind of covers.
You're still buying Eurostar tickets?
Yeah, a lot.
Right. Tell me though, from a just, you know, creative and creation perspective, what's the shift been? Because, you know, here you have, you know, a title which is of course very, this is something which you know, has fantastic imagery in it, but also there's journalism as well. You talk about, of course, you know, being an English language title. What's the difference been working in London versus Paris?
It's easier for me because it's my first language. I think they're both very different cities in terms of creativity. I think Paris maybe is more accessible on the creative side, and London is more accessible on the business side. It's quicker to get things done here, and maybe people are more open to it in Paris. I'm not entirely sure.
Right.
But both play a big part in the magazine.
Hence the shuttling back and forth between the two cities. I wanted to ask you, Rob, just going back to this issue, When you were developing printed pages, I mean, it's one interesting, when you talk about a little bit earlier about Net of Candor, you open up, and this is one of the great things about Saddle Stitch magazine. So when you have something which is stapled, that you immediately come to the centerfold, and indeed that's exactly what you have, this very provocative image as well. Given the beat that you're covering, and of course the audience that you were sort of mentioned that you're talking to, I guess, how many physical versions of this were there? You know, was it sort of a discussion? Was it going to be A5 at one point? Was it going to be large format? And you know, do you think already, have you sort of found the dream format, or could we be in for a surprise down the road, do you think?
No, I don't think so. Not that I know of anyway. But it came very quickly, and I think it was a lot to do with not just the format and not just the size and things like that. It was having a kind of illustrated cover and things like that. That those were the kind of ideas, as I say, I vividly remember standing in Artwords in Shoreditch and just looking, and everything looked kind of so similar. And that's where it started from. So actually, almost all the decisions came off the back of that. Well, actually, what's really nice, what's really, you know, and again, there's an accessibility of the content, but I think in the, you know, the fact it fits in your bag, the fact, you know, those kind of things. And so it all kind of came into play together, I think. We're very pleased with it. I think what's nice is it's a size that you can still do, like I say, have that visual wow factor occasionally if you give over a double page spread to something like that, Nadav image.
I love the Jeff McFetridge story, and someone who I think I've been sort of a bit of a patron of. I absolutely adore what he does, and great that you peeled it all back. And I'm wondering, in these early days of launching this title, how much of it has been really, I sort of always talk about the upflow and downflow of ideas. When you launch a magazine, I think that, you know, oftentimes really good brands, you know, you lead from the front. I mean, a lot of people like to talk about collaboration. I think that, you know, good brands, often you need that level of repetition to get people into it. So with these you know, as you're getting this off the ground, is it you as editor saying, look, I wanted a Jeff and I want to capture him this way? Or is it the other way around, that is someone has come to you with a really great pitch and it sort of seems right for the mix?
I think it's more democratic. Yeah, absolutely. The second thing you said, there's a group of us. We sit around, you know, take the Jeff piece. He's someone we're very interested in. And a lot of it is, you know, like I say, it's that we cover his work on the website, but we wanted to do something more in depth. And then it was, yeah, a group discussion. Someone kind of mentioned that they'd read somewhere that he had this very outdoorsy lifestyle. And so suddenly, but those things can then completely collapse. Because actually, if you go off to him and you ask him the questions and he says, oh yeah, I do love to go hiking, but it has no effect on my work, then the whole piece kind of, you know, comes down. But what was great was that he really ran with that and really talked about that. And I think it's being prepared to talk up ideas, and then there's always a leap, isn't there? There's a moment where, okay, well, is this going to stand up when we actually go and speak to these people or do the interview? And I think I trust the guys who are working for me, I, you know, trust them massively to be able to do that.
Now, you talk about editorial democracy. How many participants then are in the mix of you know, commissioning, you know, both words and pictures for something like this? Because what is it, a 68? Or I'm just guessing.
No, it's 72.
Right. You know, isn't that one of the amazing things from our trade, that, you know, you can sort of feel something, you know, exactly, you know, pretty much what the page count is. But tell me about that process for you.
I mean, there's about five of us in those meetings, both for words and pictures. I think I'm not someone who's been editing for a long time, and what I'm developing, and I'm sure you've gone through this process as well, is that mix of where you open it up and then where you have to have the confidence and the really take direction of it and go, actually, I think this is the way it works. But what I found with the people who write for me is that they're much, much better when their writing is driven and informed by passion. And so I'm much more keen to work with them to go, I really love Jeff McFetridge. I really want to talk to him about his leisure activities. Great, let's go and do that. Rather than me saying, go off and write a piece about this, and it comes out, it's more limp, it's more flabby, I think. You know, if you can give people a chance to write about what they really love, you're going to get something better back.
What's the commissioning process like at Under the Influence? And what's incredible, just taking, I think, you know, the current theme of this issue, is it you leading from the front? Is it collaborative? Is it, you know, one photographer coming with a portfolio or saying, you know, it would be great to go down this retro approach and let's, you know, revisit Brooke from her days as a model for Calvin Klein?
It's, I think I very much agree with the other statement that it's much more important to have people that are really passionate about what they want to do. So we take a lot of interest in what our collaborators are interested in. As long as it kind of fits with the theme of what we're doing and it's something that we want to go down, then we're more than happy for them to go and run with those stories or those ideas. And the Brooke cover actually was something we really wanted to do when we thought about who we would put on the cover of a coming-of-age issue. And we didn't want to put somebody of 18 years of age or out of one of the fashion stories, purely because we don't feel, and after making this issue, that you really do just come of age when you hit 18. And talking to Brooke, it was a really interesting interesting interview her ideas of her youth and her coming of age.
Right.
And so we decided that we were going to have a shot of her now, and we shot it with Michael Avedon, the grandson of Richard Avedon,
yep.
which I thought was a really a nice thing to do. He's 21 and he's the grandson of, you know, the guy that shot her for the campaigns and put her on the cover of Vogue numerous times. So it's that kind of like intricate details that people might not necessarily know about that we think of with the editorial and the creative direction of the magazine.
How much do you see yourself, I guess, as a champion of talent as well? So you talk about sort of working with Avedon Jr. in this, and of course he has in many ways a strong enough brand and will no doubt go off and have an absolutely extraordinary career. But getting that tension between, of course, emerging photographers versus, you know, established names or names that are, you know, quite confident already.
It's very important to us because as we started out, we never started out with this formula of making a successful magazine. That's not how it happened. It happened with creative people getting together and doing something they were very passionate about. So we built what we've built on younger names and emerging talent, and then we've built up from there. So we very much keep a combination of the two.
Is that a difficult tension for you? Because there is always that desire that you build a brand, and of course one of quality and certainly a portfolio where photographers want to be seen, or certainly their agents want to break them as well. So the tension of still championing the newcomer versus, it's really great. We have the ability to feature this person's work today who's much more established. Is it a difficult one for you now that you're so far into the journey?
Not really, because I think it's really important for publications to do that, to give people their platform to be the next famous photographer.
Mm.
And it's important for us also as a publication to have some kudos to find people and to work with people that we think are really great. I mean, it's not all about your name. It's often about what you can do.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the way we've worked as well. That's the way we grew.
Just, Rob, from your side with Printed Pages, I'm going to sort of veer more into the area of subject territory. Maybe talk us through the Net of Candor story, and I guess that approach. And you said that you see yourself as a journalist. It's not a creative person. I think a lot of journalists would probably like to think they're also creative as well. So don't undersell yourself. But how did that come about? And I guess, you know, through words and pictures, you know, what were you trying to tell about this, you know, award-winning, highly respected, very well-paid photographer?
I think there are two things. He was someone we were interested in. I went to see the Body show and I was introduced to him and I was very interested in doing something with him. That first stage then is all the reading round and that kind of thing. And what really hit me was a couple of things. One was that he's been interviewed, he's been covered quite a lot, but he'd never really done a very holistic interview that I came across. You know, nothing that really, I'm really interested in. What I think we've done in that piece is link his commercial work to his nudes, to his Yangtze project, and actually start to bring all those together, because it's easy to forget with someone who's as prolific and as well known as Nadav that he's the one guy, you know, doing all these different things. And actually, how do they link together? And something I'd read suggested about his childhood. And again, it was kind of taking a risk. I went to his studio, sat down with him about 5 o'clock in the evening. He was really exhausted and started just probing about it. And it started to come out that actually maybe he felt that he had quite a transient upbringing. He moved around a lot. He felt very uncomfortable when he grew up in South Africa, which is something he talks about in the piece very articulately. And suddenly you get that journalistic thing go off in your head and you just start pushing that a little bit. And it's about making those decisions while you're in the room with that person. And then he did, and he linked that to the Yangtze work and he linked it to the Body's work. And suddenly you get that sense, I think, editorially, okay, this is starting to develop. This is going in the way I want it to. Then with the images, it was kind of straightforward. You know, we'd done this very holistic thing and we knew we wanted to show all of his work. Again, it's, you know, something like the Yangtze project, there's so many to pick from, so we've got four in there of that. He talks brilliantly about the Obama shoots that he's done. He's obviously quite, you know, done that fairly regularly now, so we wanted to get an Obama in. And sometimes it's about being led by the story, and actually this is what he was talking about, this is what the story we got out of it, and then making the image selection kind of based on that and giving the story the respect, I think, to lead some of your editorial decisions.
Great. And we're going to go away for a short break. When we come back, we are going to be heading to the Catalan region. We're heading to Barcelona and a piece from our Liam Aldiss. This is The Stack on Monocle 24. Stay with us. And And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, where I'm joined by Susan Connie-Marsh and also Rob Alderson. We'll be chatting to you a little bit more in a moment, but we here at Monocle know what it means to provide our readers with a little bit of optimism, but the editorial team at Perdith magazine have gone one step further, dedicating an entire issue to the subject of happiness. Happiness has become quite the marketable commodity of late, but this magazine is no gimmicky self-help manual. It is instead a nuanced catalogue of our infatuation with said emotion and includes interviews with colourful characters about the source of their happiness and even a small briefing section titled Good News. In a country beset by bad news, it comes as no surprise that this niche magazine has already found a market, even managing to secure shelf space at London's Tate Modern and MoMA in New York. Our Madrid correspondent Liam Alda sat down with editor Marta Puig de Massa on a Barcelona terrace, and as the sun smiled down upon them, he started off by asking about the truth in the magazine's tagline, "Happiness is contagious."
You know, one time when I was reading the British Medical Journal, and there was an article published where they did some studies and some research, and they were saying that happiness was a contagious emotion, you know, like yawning in the metro. So they say that, you know, if you surround with happy people, you're most likely to be happy or to feel happy. That is the idea of the magazine, showing people who are happy and who tells you how they are happy, and so you can get inspired and be happy as well and feel a little bit better. A lot of people ask us, how did you get to be on the MoMA bookshop or the Tate Modern in London bookshop? And I said, I didn't do anything special, I just called them, so I guess it's just because of the magazine.
You said as well that it's a bit of a hobby of yours because you have another job.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is actually, I guess, what makes me happy. It's my passion and our team's passion.
Well, let's have a look through the magazine, because it's important to highlight that it's not a guide to happiness. It's dealing with the topic of happiness.
Yeah, we begin with some little pieces of good news, and then we have some profiles of people that, you know, they are just normal people that tell you how to be happy or how they are happy.
We just backtrack a little because the good news section is kind of important. It's like a little briefing of global happy good news.
There's a new about a scientist who discovered DNA proofs of Bigfoot. So every news is good for someone, so this would be good for lovers of mythical animals.
Yeah, I love that title. A piece of news for lovers of mythical animals.
Then there's another good news for students. Because they, when you were in class in a university or wherever in the school, you know, the teacher used to always tell you, don't chew your chewing gum. So someone discovered that, you know, according to the University of Cardiff, the rhythmic movement of the jaws helps for concentration.
Has always, I guess, researching the topic of happiness made you more self-conscious of your own happiness? What makes you happy?
I've always said that, you know, I'm not fanatic of anything, you know, a fan of anything specific. So maybe I'm doing this because I'm trying to see what other people are passionate about.
Have you found anything yet that's tickled your fancy?
Maybe. No. This is what makes me happy. Like, this magazine is actually my personal search for happiness in the editorial world. I've been working for different magazines, mostly in culture and travel, but there was nothing that I thought I want to work here, or I would really feel satisfied there. So I decided to create this magazine.
The name, Perdiz, what's the significance of the name?
There's a sad phrase in Spanish, feliz como una perdiz, which is as happy as a lark would be in English. So yeah, that's the reason. So you can find the magazine in our website, which is perdizmagazine.com. We distribute it also in 10 different countries right now. Spain, US, UK, Germany, Poland, France, like all Europe, and I think also Australia right now. And then within that big, we just want to do a magazine that we really like. Our circulation is, by now it's about 2,000 copies. As there's no commercial, you know, pressure for us. Like, our idea from the beginning was to have, you know, one sponsor per magazine.
Which is an interesting business model.
It is for us because it doesn't, you know, fill up the magazine with with annoying ads. And instead we have these things that we call nice things that are art, photography, illustration. The idea behind this is that beauty stimulates part of your brain that are related to pleasure. So we want the readers to feel good after reading the magazine, not only after reading the content, but also for the nice things they can see.
Let's just approach the topic of the bilingual aspect of the magazine as well, because it's interesting.
Yeah, the magazine is in Spanish and English, just because, you know, we wanted to reach the, you know, most people we can. And some people ask me why it's not in Catalan, because, you know, we are from Barcelona, I'm Catalan. And I don't know, for me it didn't make sense. I mean, I would do it in three languages, but it would be, you know,
yeah, it's a lack of space.
a complete nightmare. So I don't know, it was a practical reason.
Do you feel as well, obviously, you want to take advantage of the entire Spanish market and perhaps the Latin American market as well as the English market at the same time? Obviously, you're expanding your horizons.
Yeah, and also, I mean, as you know, here in Spain, I think it would be difficult for a lot of people to buy a magazine only in English. Also, like, some people from bookshops told me that some people approach them and tell them that it's interesting also, maybe because, you know, they're from the UK and they are learning Spanish, so...
Be happy and learn a language at the same time. Does it make you happy as well to know that you're spreading that positive energy? I mean, it sounds a little bit mystic, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, if I wasn't doing this magazine, I would feel, like, way more miserable. Yeah, of course, I mean, it makes me happy to see that the feedback from everybody has been so great that it makes me feel very satisfied with what I'm doing.
And that was Perdiz editor Marta Puigdemassa speaking with our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldis, in Barcelona. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We dive into our magazines right after this. And you are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We have the editor and creative director of Under the Influence and also the editor of Printed Pages here in studio. And speaking of Printed Pages, I'm going to put you on the spot, Rob. We should probably get to the lovely looking stack that you've brought in to studio today. I'm not going to ask you to start with your magazine, which you put on the very top. I think we should maybe sort of dig down a little bit deeper. What do you want to start with?
This is an interesting one because I literally received this morning. I think this has just come out, this magazine. It's a magazine called Flana, which has been coming out from Germany. And it's really fascinating because I was going to bring Boat Magazine, and I have bought Boat Magazine, and I love Boat Magazine. I think it's brilliant. And I think actually the Kyoto issue, content-wise particularly, was one of the strongest ones they've done. Up there with the Detroit one, which was the first one I came across. This goes even further, though. Whereas Boat picks a city, Flaneur picks a single street. And for this issue, it's Kantstrasse in Berlin. And they have various people, photographers, writers, illustrators, responding to this one street. And I mean, I don't know how much further we can go in this direction. The next magazine will be a house or a corner. But I think it's brilliant. And I flicked through it today on the train. And I think it's really beautifully designed. It's interesting. It's a really good read. I mean, you know, I couldn't really get that much of a sense of it, you know, because there's so much content there. So,
right. Well, what we have is something large format. It has a very tactile, you know, quite thick brown paper stock with a sort of a, you know, a faded yellow. Seems like they've gone through a bit of a, you know, a special process as well in terms of a print technique for the cover. And then it is mixing you know, a variety of just, you know, I think great typography, you know, various grids that they play with you know, throughout. But this just, yeah, as you said, this very, very niche, you know, very narrow celebration of a very iconic street, you know, in the city. But I think, you know, you do raise an interesting point. You know, we see the newsstand, you know, becoming, you know, ever more niche in terms of themes and whatnot. I just want to ask you, was this a title that you sent for it and it thumped on your desk, or it just arrived and the timing was right for the show today?
No, it literally dropped onto my desk this morning, which was fantastic timing. It's one of the best things doing what I do. We get sent all sorts of publications and magazines and books, and it's a huge pleasure to be able to take them away. But I have to say, one of the things that really frustrates me about so a lot of the titles that we kind of come across is, you know, I talked about, it's obviously a fantastically designed thing and a lot of them are, but in terms of the content, sometimes things are a little bit disappointing. You take them away for the weekend and actually after 20 minutes, you're kind of done with it. And I really love to see stuff that, you know, great design is fantastic, but the magazine industry is not going to kind of survive and grow and thrive if we start to relegate content.
I see you nodding. I'm not sure exactly you were nodding at, Susan, but what was it?
Just the same thing. I'm always attracted to design initially. Hence I brought this one here as well.
Don't give it away yet, but we'll come to the moment. But yeah.
You have to have the content, because that's one thing I've noticed as well. I'm always attracted to the design, and then you have a look, and like you said, it's, you have to have things that you can read and you can get into. And I think the best thing about a bigger publication, especially if it's biannual, is to stay around, something that you can dip in and out of, and there's a lot to read and there's a lot to think about, and often you don't find that.
I'm not sure if you were able to dip into it before we went on air. I'm not sure if Rob was sharing his titles with you when you were in the waiting room before we started. But for first impressions so far, what camp does it fall into after a couple of flicks?
I didn't have a look at this before, so it's the first time I've seen it. I think it looks great. It's beautifully designed, and I would be interested to read what there is to read. But I don't know whether you've had time to do that. And
I spent a little bit of time with it through the course of today, but yeah, I mean I'm blown away by it. I mean, it is a complete coincidence that it arrived this morning, but I really would have bought it kind of anyway.
I probably would have too. So,
Susan, where do you want to go with what you've got on top, or what you're sort of grabbing there that you're referencing earlier? So
the AA Files is the Architectural Association magazine, and again, I think it's similar. The reason
similar in terms of format.
Similar
as well.
In terms of format, and just nicely designed, very simple, nice archive images, actually quite a lot to read, puts things in a historical context. And if you're interested in architecture, I think it's a really beautifully designed magazine for that.
And also, curiously, it also surprises you that it's actually quite light. And I don't mean sort of light in content, not at all. But you look at sort of large format, but they've gone for a slightly, and this is the AA Files, the 66th edition of it. But they've gone for a slightly lighter stock, but a stock which very little show through, and of really, you know, outstanding quality as well. And I think just also, again, sort of playing with a really, you know, interesting grid throughout it as well. You're looking at it, Rob, like it landed from space or not. Or admiring.
No, absolutely. This is how I always look when I'm getting a new magazine. It's part jealousy, part kind of admiration. That's just how my face sits. What's interesting is there's a lot of text. It feels, you know, there's a lot of actual just words in this thing, and I'm interested to see the ways they're playing around with it to try and mitigate that effect of it being slightly too intimidating. And there's quite a few nice little neat design tricks and stuff. But there are some, I mean, it feels heavy duty. I mean, I'm looking at a page here, which is all text and footnotes. Which is,
I mean, we come across this quite frequently on this program. So you're looking at it with maybe sort of, you know, maybe a slight degree of jealousy. Are you able to sort of separate the leisure side of your mind when it comes to reading versus the more professional competitive side when it comes to consuming periodicals?
No, absolutely not. I think that's a kind of, you know, something that goes with the job, unfortunately, is that you're never going to switch that off. And I think that's good. You know, I think there's always things, even if, you know, you're in a doctor's waiting room and you pick up some kind of awful title, it's like, but there's something you can learn about it, something they've done with the captions or with the contents that you kind of go, oh, okay, that's interesting. So no, I think it's if you start losing that, you're probably a little bit too comfortable, maybe.
And do you have desk triage? Do you have those titles which you savor, those that you devour immediately, and then there's ones that are sort of in between that are maybe sort of, you know, you'll dip into a few articles and you'll give them a little bit more time, but then in fact, that they might not go on the shelf even.
Yeah, that's certainly true. There's certainly titles that come into the It's Nice, That Studio, which, you know, everyone's looking at like hawks as soon as they arrive and trying to grab and that kind of thing. I'd say what I try and do is take them all away for the weekend and try and read them, really delve into my, you know, that experience. For me, it's not enough for a magazine to have a couple of neat design tricks or one or two neat articles. It needs to be a thing that's saying, asking people to part with their money and say, you know, this is why it's good, and trying to get that holistic look is something we're very big on. And with printed pages, you know, we want it to be an experience start to finish. I'm sure you're the same. And it's like I say, it's in an increasingly competitive marketplace, it's not enough to have the odd advantage, the odd good thing. You know, the whole thing needs to work.
And just to tell us, what are the must-reads? What are people fighting over in your studio?
I would say Fantastic Man, when it comes in, which I've brought with me. I saw Herten Jop do a talk in Amsterdam recently, and I think that's the one. As soon as it comes in, you know, you have to be quick to get that, and you have to maybe, I talked about a democracy, but sometimes lay down the editor's law, and I have to have Fantastic Man when that arrives.
Okay, what else? It can't just be that. I mean, we love Herten Jop, but... what are some of the others?
I think Port, you know, increasingly they're doing really interesting things, and I think everyone's very keen to see how that's developing, although they've obviously had a bit of a row this week about their front cover. So that's always snapped up. Green Soccer Journal again, which is something I've brought with me. People really, really keen to get that. And I think, you know, if things like Elephant, Kilimanjaro, I always remember those kind of things, you know, harder to snatch up because of their size.
And Susan, for you, must reads? Aside from what you've got today, but you just it can be, you can, you know, indulge us in if there are things which perhaps are not so esoteric as well.
I actually read Port as well. I find it really interesting. I think there's a lot in there. I'm bad with reading magazines, to be honest. It's the same. I have the same. I can't switch off from it, and I spend so much time dealing with our magazine that I find it hard to really spend that time. I look at a lot of others. I'm not sure that I kind of read on a regular basis.
Are reading that much. Yeah. So from a competitive point of view, I guess, and I guess probably that's what you're saying as well, you're taking a lot of cues looking. Is there that sense then when you're doing that of, damn, we missed that, or the other side of just, you know, this is really inspirational, but, you know, I need to also, you know, curb my creative ambitions because, you know, you don't want to also be, you know, it happens to all of us, I guess, you don't want to be too influenced sometimes as well.
Well, that's why I do steer away from it more so now than before we set up the magazine. I used to read a lot of magazines, look at a lot of magazines. And now I find that that you do get those feelings, and it's something that you probably want to avoid because you don't want to be influenced by what somebody else is doing. And you don't want to feel like you've missed out on something because you are creating your own thing. And if you start to kind of try to do what somebody else is doing, then you lose out what you set out to do. And I think it's really important to stick to that vision and not get sidetracked by what other people are doing and along those lines.
I want to ask both of you, because, of course, this is a program which, you know, is very much here to, of course, you know, build up and underline the importance of print. But how do both of your titles, and Rob, I'll start with you, how does Printed Pages live digitally? Does it live digitally?
It has a very simple one-page website, which has the color designed with the color of the cover each time, which changes. One paragraph of text and a selection of maybe six spreads, and that's it.
And that is a sampler to drive people to subscribers or send them to newsstand.
Yeah, absolutely. To buy through the website. We obviously will cover it on It's Nice That. We'll give a nod to it. But we're confident enough that this stuff needs to be seen and engaged with in print. And because of the cover price, we're happy that that's the way we're giving it out. What's interesting, though, in talking to people for editorial sometimes, you know, the reach of a magazine compared to, say, the website, and they want some. So that might be an issue we come across going forward. I don't know.
Susan, from your side?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a basic website as well. It's very clean. We are developing that to have some online content, but it's something that we, again, didn't rush into doing because we wanted to concentrate on our actual product, which was the print. I think it's something in our realm and our genre of magazine that we probably do need to move into, but we're doing it slowly. We're kind of working on one thing at a time and building like that. So
very clever, both of you. We're going to go away for a little short break before we have the run to the home stretch here on The Stack on Monocle 24. We're back right after this break.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? A different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Nockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Falooda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's The Menu, in association with Krug.
The results are out. Monocle's 7th annual Quality of Life survey has shuffled the deck and ranks the cities we think are most livable in 2013. And the winner is Copenhagen.
This is a population and a city that's become markedly more extrovert in recent years. There's more life on the streets than ever before, and its people are not only more engaged locally, but also eager to show Copenhagen off to the rest of the world. Copenhageners have hit a high point of pride in their city, and it shows.
Copenhagen, our film about the best city to call home. On Monocle.com.
Back with the Stack here on Monocle 24, where I'm joined by Rob Alderson today, the editor of Printed Pages, and Susan Connie Marsh, editor-in-chief and creative director of Under the Influence magazine. You left us, well, the last title you were looking at was the AA's magazine, but Rob, what else have you brought in today?
I've bought the first, I'm very interested in first issues. That's something, there's someone who relaunched, you know, was a part of a relaunch of a magazine. I think it's really interesting to see how people, you know, because so much thought's gone into it, and to see that first bang. So I've got this magazine called Special Request, which came out a couple of weeks ago, I think, which is kind of, I suppose, just under A4 format. Very, very bright pink cover with a kind of slightly gaudy gold lettering and title. What's interesting is it's food is the theme for this issue. And I am a little bit over food magazines. You know, I think we've started to see a little bit, become a little bit cliche.
I don't want to say hooray because I love food magazines, but I'm thrilled that someone's actually gone on record and said this on the program. Tell us, why are you over food magazines?
Because I feel, unfortunately, they have kind of rushed to join a bandwagon, and they've started being quite conservative and all kind of doing the same thing, and all you get the same, even set designers and photographers cropping up in them. And I don't know, it's this fantastic, you know, there's obviously a huge interest in food, but it doesn't, again, feel like people have thought about it necessarily in the right way of, well, how does this live in a magazine? People are like, oh, let's just do a food magazine. And I think there's some fantastic ones, and I think there's some quite average ones. And so this was interesting because it was a food special. So I have to say, my initial, it took a couple of days for me to open it, A, because of the pink, and B, because it was a food and I wasn't that interested. But when I took it home and spent some time with it, I was actually really impressed, and I thought that they did some genuinely interesting things, you know, some features. They've got a photographic feature taking chef's hands pictures, and they've got you know, some really silly nice stuff about famous people, what they have in their sandwiches, but it's put together really nicely, photographed well. There's some really good longer form essays as well. I was really blown away by it, actually, and they're doing TV for the next one. They're going to do a different kind of cultural thing each time, so it'd be interesting to see if they
The editor was on a few weeks ago talking to our Andrew Tuck, and I'm sure he'll be absolutely thrilled to hear that he doesn't, he hasn't sort of joined the league of those other titles. It's interesting, something that came up over, you know, over drinks, I believe, in this building a little while ago, maybe even the rant was even a bit more harsh about the new league of food magazines as well, but also someone sort of distilled some of them as also that, you know, that no one was having any sex with those magazines, not that they were not having sex on the pages, but it was all very sort of just, you know, frigid and very still, and actually in a very curious way, you talk about sort of the celebratory nature of food, that it was all a little bit too composed as well.
I think it's a problem with a lot of new titles, you know, we're, you know, an element of fun.
Yeah.
This is meant to be...
Sorry, just can you pass the title over? I wasn't going to hit you or something. I just haven't seen that issue.
I think that's a thing we've lost sometimes in with printers, that it's meant to be fun. It's meant to be this joyous experience. It's something we always think about in printed pages. You know, even if we're covering quite, you know, Nadav's piece, it's quite a in-depth interview and, you know, cover some big issues, but you still want that sense of fun and that sense of life. And I think some magazines are a bit po-faced and they're a bit trendy and they're a bit too cool for school, and I'm kind of over that. I want something more. I want to enjoy the experience of this.
I mean, there's a great story in here as well, and maybe it was, you know, Andrew covered a few weeks ago, but a great story by Liam, a work of photo story, fashion story as well, in many ways, which could be sort of almost in any other magazines, but also how it's paired with Crustacea, which is absolutely absolutely brilliant. I want to, I know Susan, maybe I'm not sure if you can manage three titles at once, but which one do you want to talk about there?
This is a fashion magazine by Lisa Safati, and it's a one-off publication. There was a spate of these, I think there's one I've got here as well, that was Martin Parr, that was done, and I just found them really interesting. I found the concept great. I think this comes from the documentary photography background that I come from, liking the images, feeling they feel very humanistic. It's not just a fashion shoot. It's you relate to the girls in it, and then you're also seeing product, and it's shot in a really great way. It's kind of like a film set.
Mm. And just like that, a very different discipline as well. Mm. When you know you are venturing out, and it is going to be a one-off, and there's no discussion that, might there be an issue two or three? No, this is, and so it becomes very singular in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically a photography book, but it's got brands in there, and it's been curated as a fashion magazine.
Mm. Lots of titles to go through still, but not too many minutes left on the clock. So I'm going to ask you one last title you want to go to. I love our good friends at Fantastic Man, but I'm not going to allow you to talk about that. So you have to pick up something else.
Okay. Well, if I can, I'd like to talk very quickly about the Green Soccer Journal. And I've got quite an old copy here because that was the only one I could find in the studio today, which shows that they've been snaffled probably since then. The point I make about this, and it actually goes on from what we were talking about food, is that there's so much writing about football, particularly online. And what I think Green Soccer Journal proves is that there's no such thing as a kind of a hack subject. There's hack approaches to subjects. And actually, it's very possible to write about food or football in a very boring, cliched way. But actually, if you take the care and you have the editorial ideas and the editorial creativity, you can put together something which is amazing. And I think the Green Soccer Journal played to this kind of generation of so-called hipster football fans and people who weren't kind of big knuckle-dragging lads down the pub. There are people who are interested in football and they're interested in other things. And I think what these guys do, as I say, for me, their content-led approach is really special, and it's a real example and a reference point I use quite a lot as well.
Do you think it has longevity? I mean, I'm not really interested in football unless it's World Cup time, but nevertheless, I can appreciate it as a journalistic and also as an art direction exercise. But I sometimes wonder, though, if I look at stadia around the world, that, you know, I'm not saying everyone's a knuckle dragger necessarily, but how narrow is it, and whether they can whether they can sustain it.
Well, I think for me, I mean, just picking up this issue, which I say is a little bit old now, but the strength of the idea is the first section. They've got a piece on the rebirth of the New York cosmos, which is, again, it's about football, but it's about all sorts of other things. That's actually really a story about
It's a great business story.
America, things, they've got a great story about Justin Fashanu, and that's actually a story about society and acceptance and those kind of things. Mm. And I think they will have longevity if they still have that approach and that eye for a story. You know, it's that old thing, like it's a football magazine about everything but football. Of course it is about football, but it's also about loads of other things, and that will give it longevity, I think. Mm.
Okay. It's in your hand, Susan. Last title for the show. Which
well,
one's going to be?
Well, let's go for The Plant.
Okay.
Which I think is a similar thing to that. It's very specific what it's talking about, but I think it's done in a really nice way. It's personal. There's stories that you about people's gardens that you want to get into. It's cute. It's designed nicely.
Is it aspirational for you? Does it make you want to go down to a nursery and put on your wellies and devote a Sunday to?
Well, yeah, I did that this Sunday. I planted some tomatoes, so yeah, I would say so. I love gardening though.
Okay, so this is cool. Okay, so this is and obviously it's a very visual magazine, but and plenty to read. And I'm wondering, did The Plant also entice you to actually hear people's stories as well?
Yeah, I think it's I haven't again managed to read all through it. I've just got these just before the weekend, and actually did spend the time outside at the weekend. So, but I think it's something that I do want to read.
You were brave, at least unless it was late Sunday afternoon in London.
It was.
Yeah. It wasn't great. Also, another magazine which is much loved on the program. I'm going to have to leave it there. Susan Connie Marsh, thanks very much for coming on today. Also, Rob Alderson, of course, from Printed Pages, thanks very much for that. Of course, you can catch us every Saturday, same time, here on Monocle 24. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager behind the glass tape is Chris Fitch. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday, same time. Very different place, though. As I said at the top of the program, we are going to be coming to you from the TCDC in Bangkok. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes, but for now, for me, Tyler Berlay, goodbye.